can make sure that we're more climate resilient. So that's thinking about our most vulnerable community members and making sure that they're homes are prepared. I mean, a lot of the people that died during the heat dome were housed, and it was that their homes weren't, you know, set up for these extreme weather. So there are ways that we can make sure that especially our elderly folk, elderly Portlanders, people of color have what they need to make sure that they can stay safe during these huge climate intense climate times like we will be experiencing tomorrow. We need to be thinking about large, bigger steps that we need to take, and also smaller ones. Like on a bigger scale, we just need to be moving away from fossil fuels. We need to get serious about taking care of those tanks holding hazardous substances. And then also, you know, on a smaller level that will make a big difference too, is making sure that we're meeting our climate goals through making it safer to bike, scooter, walk, take public transit, and be moving away from using cars. And also, I mean, when you think about like a bustling, fun city, you think about one where there's a lot of walking and biking, and you're not thinking about sitting in your car in traffic. Tree canopy is also a priority for me, specifically with an equity lens. Shade equity is really real. You can just take a bike ride from East Portland to Laurelhurst Park and see how different it feels. And we know that it's recorded that oftentimes in East Portland, it can be 20 degrees hotter than it is in other parts of Portland. Another important thing is making sure that we are protecting those Portland Clean Energy PSEF funds, making sure that we're really communicating with the public how those funds are being spent, what projects are happening. I have gotten the privilege of getting to see some of those up close from seeing some of these depave projects where, you know, a whole bunch of pavement is now a garden for middle schoolers at Oliver Middle School, seeing some solar projects, making sure that those funds are protected, they're not used to fill budget holes, and are really used to make Portland more climate resilient.
You know, to circle back around to some of the climate issues, and, you know, we can also frame them as disaster preparedness in some ways, thinking about the CEI hub, thinking about the Zenith agreement. I'm curious for those who are here, like, is that something that you would revisit? How would you approach that kind of thing?
A few years ago, the legislature empowered DEQ to regulate the Critical Energy Infrastructure Hub, and DEQ required the companies to do an assessment of the vulnerability of their tanks, which was supposed to have been completed a few months ago, and I'm surprised I haven't seen any news about it. And then DEQ was also empowered to require retrofits of tanks if they're unsafe. So if they go ahead and do that, then that's great. And I'm surprised I haven't seen more news about that, and I apologize for not having, like, bugged DEQ and asked them what's going on. The county has also taken up the idea of risk bonds and requiring the companies to be sure that they have enough money to pay for all the damage that occurs in an earthquake. And that's important and that's good, but I'd much rather the damage didn't occur to begin with. I mean, having billions of dollars would be nice, but not having the entire city destroyed would be even nicer. So I think that we need to be following up with DEQ and seeing, you know, if they are actually going to implement tough regulations that require that the companies move their tanks or make them safer.
Very concerned about these CEI hubs. I know that a lot of these big companies are very litigious, and I also am open to, you know, thinking about revoking, how can we revoke permits? How can we do risk bonding? How can we make sure that we're really putting the pressure on to make some real changes? And I also am committed to bringing in experts who have dedicated decades or their entire life to this. So I'm leaning on people from 350 PDX, from the Sunrise Movement, from Braided River, and the founder of Sunnyside Environmental School, Sarah Taylor. She took me out to Linton and showed me, you know, what some of those businesses are doing and what is actually just going straight into our river. I mean, that river is a huge part of our ecosystem and affects all of us, and we should all care about that. And she was, you know, telling me how we can do some things on city council, like fight for a 100-foot setback to make sure that there is a buffer from the river so companies can't just be so close and be dumping things into them. And those are things I want to get really serious about.
So right in line with this question, last question is, what is your take on the Zenith Energy deal that was negotiated out of the public eye by Commissioners Rubio and Ryan, which allows Zenith to continue its operations for the next 5 years? We'll start over here with Tiffany Koyama Lane.
Yeah, I know it did a lot of damage in terms of, in a lot of ways, but in one big way is with relationships. There are a lot of folks that have lost trust, are, you know, really feeling like they can't work with some of those folks in office, and I think that's really real. I have had some conversations, some heart-to-hearts, and I think there's some hope that there can be some repair, but yeah, I understand why so many community members feel frustrated and feel like there was a backroom deal that was made that was not okay. And I mean, anytime there can be more transparency, that's something that I'm going to support. So always pushing for community members to be brought in on decisions is going to be the way I want to go.
There's a trend in national politics where local elections like this one are labeled nonpartisan. In fact, all of you are classified as nonpartisan candidates. And it's done partly to keep national issues out of local issues. But, I mean, everything we're dealing with here in Portland is a national issue. Housing, drugs, crime. And all the candidates that I saw running for District 3, you know, are labeled nonpartisan. So I wanted to ask, in many elections, you know, party affiliations of candidates are either generally known or known through, you know, certain endorsements. Like, for instance, a candidate being endorsed by a labor union would generally be considered to be associated with Democrats, whereas a candidate endorsed by a business group might generally be considered to be endorsed by Republicans. So I'd like to ask each of you, how do you define the term nonpartisan?
Technically, this is a nonpartisan race, which means that we're not a part represented by a political party. But as you said, contributions, endorsements all show a different story, right? I was endorsed by the Working Families Party. I think that says something about me. I think the fact that, you know, one of our mayoral candidates has retweeted a hate preacher, proud patriot prayer guy, or that he had to add Democrat to his yard signs to prove that he's a Democrat in the city of Portland because some of his affiliations seemed very right wing, I would say, you know, that there are things that you do to indicate your values, even in a nonpartisan race.
Well, you are listening to Running on Air, a production of KBOO Community Radio. I'm your host, Althea Billings. We're going to take a quick musical break. We'll be back in a few. Are listening to KBOO Community Radio. I'm Althea Billings, the news director. In this episode, we are revisiting Running on Air, our Portland candidate roundtable series. We're hearing from the winners of District 3. That's Angelita Murillo, Tiffany Koyama Lane, and Steve Novick. They'll be taking office in the new year. Before we get back to them, I want you to consider supporting the important work that we do here at KABU with a donation during our Catalog of Connections drive. We're trying to raise $75,000 by the end of the year. If you can help us out, now is a great time to do it. Donate online at kabu.fm/give or text the word KABU to 44321 to show your support for grassroots community radio like this. Any donation amount is very helpful, and we appreciate it. So let's get back to the show. I want to ask you all about another one of the big issues that came from our survey, and economic livability and affordability was really important. So what are some of the things that Portland could do to become more affordable for people who want to stay?
New York City housing is expensive, but people spend a lot less on transportation because even though the subway is not fareless, paying a subway fare is a lot cheaper than making payments on a car and buying gasoline and buying insurance on a car and paying for repairs. So the more we make it possible for people to get around without having spending tons of money on their car, the better off we are. In terms of housing, yes, we have incredible housing affordability problems here. Unfortunately, that's a nationwide and even a worldwide problem. The New York Times had an article a month ago about how Kalamazoo, Michigan now has a housing crisis because for a variety of reasons in the wake of the Great Recession, banks became much more conservative about loaning to build housing, developers became more conservative, and now, of course, we have really high interest rates. We are short tens of thousands of housing units in the city, and it's going to take a while to make that up. There are things that we can do. We can continue to change the zoning laws to make it legal to build more types of housing. When I was on the council before, I was the first person to say we need to loosen up the zoning laws so that you can build duplexes and triplexes in places where they were previously illegal. We can improve the permitting system in a variety of ways. Another thing that we can do is the nonprofits that build affordable housing, people make fun of them because an affordable unit can be $400,000 to build. But the nonprofits point out that they need to pull together funding streams from the city, the county, the state, the feds, metro, et cetera. And each of those funding streams has dozens of requirements for them to meet, and the requirements aren't aligned. So that's one thing I think we could do with the city is sit down with metro, the state, et cetera, and try to make it easier to build so-called affordable housing.
When candidates are running for office, one of the complaints I hear sometimes is that they tend to talk in generalities rather than specifics. In other words, they're very clear about what the problems are, but not as clear as to what the solutions should be. From your perspective, do you think that's true? And if so, why?
I do think that a lot of candidates, especially under the prior form of government, had very general answers to a lot of the hard questions that we're facing. And I think part of that is because you are advised to become palatable and malleable for every room that you get into so that you can get as many donations as possible and as many endorsements as possible. I think that under the new district system and under the ranked choice voting system, you have more freedom to actually be yourself and state your values and your policies. I am someone who feels very, very strongly about the public having access to full information and a say in the policies that we create. So my policy platform on my website is very clear. I have specific solutions for specific problems, and I don't change what I say in any room that I'm in. So I have seen that as an issue before, and I try very hard not to replicate it.
Do you think that perception of Portland or the outside view, where does that rank for you?
I think it's important. It's important in terms of tourism, and it's important in terms of housing investment. I think that we probably have beaten ourselves up a little too much and contributed to the bad perception of Portland, but we do have real problems. And I think that if the word goes out that Portland is getting folks off the street and into humane shelter arrangements like tiny house villages, if the word goes out that Portland, that crime has declined dramatically in Portland. It was never as bad as some people think, but it did spike during the pandemic, certainly violent crime. Then remember, just like 10 years ago, Portland was being glorified every week in the New York Times. So I think that all we have to do is get to the point where we could say, hey, Portland's back. We're still the wonderful, sophisticated, but at the same time adorable place that we were in 2013. So come on back.
You know, I've interviewed several candidates during this Running on Air series, and they all have said something very similar, each of them. And that is, people need to be engaged. you can only do so much. And it's the responsibility of the public to actually let you know what they want and to actually show up. And since I'm hearing that from so many candidates, I want to ask you, do you feel like that the public is having a hard time taking responsibility for their politics?
Most people aren't taught what their city council does. I was in an Oregon politics class at PSU, and we never touched on what local government does or how to access them. If I hadn't worked in constituent services at City Hall, I wouldn't have ever learned, as someone who grew up from in an immigrant family, how you go and sign up to testify for your local city council. I also think that there's been a lot of disillusionment in who is going to actually listen to people. So I think the new charter form of government, the districts, and the ranked choice voting is going to make people far more engaged because they're going to feel like they have someone that actually represents their values. But on top of that, I have felt really passionately about doing outreach so that people are informed about their local government, because oftentimes, you know, someone will put a flyer in the darkest corner of a hallway and be like, but we invited you guys to come testify. And if it's not easily accessible to the public and they don't hear about it and they don't know about it and you're not meeting them where they are, then how are they going to engage or know about the issue? So I created a TikTok account called PNW Policy Angel, that's the handle, where I explain local government and politics and give updates on what's going on, obviously through my own political lens. And I have found that a lot of people did want to be engaged. They signed up to testify on city budgets, county budgets, everything. When people know that something is happening, they show up. But we have to actually meet the public where they are and make it as accessible as possible to them.
You know, I want to stick with you for a minute, Ms. Murillo. I was mm-hmm. going through your Instagram, and this post caught my attention.
Mm-hmm.
I cry a lot, but I'm so productive, it's an art. It's strange watching my tax dollars used to bomb innocent people abroad, our mm-hmm. Supreme Court callously reviewing how much we should punish homeless people for the crime of sleeping outside, and dark money groups shaping our elections. Even so, we press on. And I mean, I know that you've got almost 5,000 Instagram followers and like 35,000 followers on TikTok, but this sounds like one of those times where the politics is really personal. Is mm-hmm. it for you?
Oh, I think all politics are personal. I think the personal is political, as is always said. I think I feel that my liberation is deeply tied with the liberation of others, and I don't think that any of us can be free until all of us are free. So I think the fact that Yeah, I think it's exactly that. The fact that the money that I am paying to our government to help protect and take care of our own citizens is being used to harm other people in other countries that I have no beef with, right? These are government to government issues, is really disheartening. And I think the fact that the majority of Americans want a ceasefire, want an end to wars, don't want to engage in this sort of thing, and that we don't have a say in what our tax dollars do because both presidential candidates have not taken a strong stance against it, is very concerning.
Steve, reducing gun violence has been an important campaign issue for you, and you've offered some creative solutions. Can you talk us through some of those ideas?
Sure. One thing that I've talked about, because a friend of mine who follows gun issues pointed it out to me, is that Portland strangely lags behind the rest of the state in using the state's red flag law it's a civil process to take guns away from people who are a danger to themselves and others. And I've asked the police chief about it, and he's only been chief for a little while, and doesn't know exactly why that is. I think that it must just be that when the red flag law was passed, for whatever reason, Portland didn't go through the kind of education process with its police force and with the general public on the red flag law as like Bend did. Bend uses it a lot, but Washington and Clackamas counties use it more than we do. I suspect the red flag law probably has more of an influence on suicide than homicides, but the lives matter just as much either way. I think that in terms of using the police to address gun violence, I mean, Boston actually has managed somehow to, the first 6 months of this year, they only had 4 murders. Now, obviously, that's partly luck, but it's pretty eye-catching. And what they've done is they've identified, crime tends to be extremely place-specific. They identified the 150 places in the city that are most associated with large amounts of crime, and they devoted a lot of resources, both police resources and investment in community anti-violence programs, in order to make those areas safer. Another thing that I'm particularly concerned about, another form of gun violence, is youth suicides. When I was on the council before, perhaps the best thing I did was the Vista Bridge had been a place people went to commit suicide for 80 years. I put up a barrier and put an end to that. And youth suicide, obviously, is a major thing. And I mean, the last year I've heard statistics from 857 American kids shot themselves, with mostly with their parents' guns. And it occurred to me some years ago, after I was on the council, you know, there are the things called smart guns that only the legal owner can fire using fingerprint or other technology. But the gun industry hasn't made them, because when they started to, the NRA called for a boycott of Smith & Wesson, which is going to make them, because the NRA thought if smart guns existed, legislators would start banning dumb guns. Now, I think Smith & Wesson was dumb to pull back, because polls showed a lot of gun-interested people would like to buy smart guns. But what occurred to me is cities buy a lot of guns. If Portland said, we want to buy smart guns for our police force, which was smart for the police too, because 1 out of 10 police officers who are shot with their own guns. And if Portland went to Los Angeles and Seattle and San Francisco and said, hey, will you join us as announcing to the world that you want to buy smart guns for our police forces, then the gun manufacturers would have a guaranteed market and they'd start making them for the cities, but then they'd also be generally available. So that is a particular goal of mine, something that if I'm on the council, I will make that a high priority. Curiously, the only other people in the country who seem to have thought of this are the former mayor of Cincinnati and the mayors of Dayton and Toledo, Ohio.
Hmm.
They've sort of made this challenge to the gun industry, but
the brain trust.
Yeah, but for some reason, like people in New York and Chicago, et cetera, didn't pick it up. So I'm proud to stand with my fellow gun thoughtful allies in Toledo and Cincinnati and Dayton.
Let me go to Miss Angelique, Miss Murillo. Miss Murillo, I saw you shaking your head.
Yeah, I think it is a myth that there is an abundance of services available. In fact, the Hoover Treatment Center for Addiction is turning away 200 people a month because there are not enough beds for people who are begging to go into treatment. There are not enough shelter beds. As someone who works with unhoused people pretty regularly through my anti-hunger policy work, as someone who just does that in my spare time, I can also say that there's a lot of issues with the shelter systems because they are not autonomously run and they don't give dignity and choice to the unhoused people that live there. So what I'm hearing on the ground from unhoused people that I talk to directly all the time is that there are often a lot of physical assaults, power dynamics that happen between staff and the people who live there because they don't have a choice in what's going on, and they're afraid to make reports because they are afraid of losing the very little support that they already have. So this idea that there is just an abundance of shelters and treatment centers and everything's great and people are just not wanting to go, I don't believe in service resistance. I think that there is a reason that people don't want to go into the shelters, and we need to take a critical eye and ask those people why. And the shelters like Dignity Village that have worked, because Dignity Village is great, Right to Dream is another great autonomous shelter model. The reason those shelters work is because they have councils that are comprised of unhoused people that live there who are making collective decisions together. And when you have public buy-in from the people that are living in the community, it creates a different standard for each other, for accountability, and it also creates safety because you're removing power over others.
Ms. Jane, your thoughts?
Steve, any thoughts on the police accountability that's coming into force once this new council takes shape?
I'm glad the voters approved its civilian oversight of the police. I confess I have not followed with as much detail like the debate over whether we have 21 members or 33 members. There's another police accountability concern that I have, which is that we've seen in the past, under the old system, the city would try to fire people who've been involved in really egregious behavior, and then the union would take that to arbitration. The arbitrators would say, well, you're departing from your previous standards, and therefore the person's going to get reinstated. And I'm worried that that might happen again. There's something else that is, there's a body in the State Licensing Board for Public Safety, the DPSST, that can simply take people's licenses away, period. And they do it very rarely. Maybe part of the reason for that is that virtually everybody in the DPSST is in public safety in one way or another. So a criminal defense lawyer I know said the city should advocate for, at the state level, changing the composition of the DPSST so there's more public members, so it's not so heavily public safety oriented.
You've been listening to an encore presentation of Running on Air, KBOO's Portland Candidate Roundtable series. We've been hearing what the future city councilors from District 3 told us on the campaign trail. Tune in for all of the episodes of KBOO News Year in Review now until January 1st. I want to give a special thank you to all of the KBOO folks that helped make Running on Air happen. Thank you to the hosts, Lenita Duke, Barbara Bernstein, Don Merrill, Corey Elia, Annette Newell, Lisa Loving, Sam Bowman, and Reed Johnson. Thank you to the editors, of course, Eric Leuschner and Ray Bodwell. Thank you to Ender Black, Arthur Rosado, Bob Davis, Nate Kapp, and Asia Hawthorne for all your help. I also want to thank our KBOO interns, Patches and Alex. None of the important work that we do here at KBOO can happen without the support of amazing volunteers and from listeners like you. If you've appreciated KBOO this year, consider supporting us with a donation. It's our end of year membership drive, and it's a great time to do it. KBOO.fm/give is the place to donate online. You can also text the word KBOO to 44321 or mail us a check. We love getting mail. Our address is 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. I'm Althea Billings, news director here at KBOO. Thanks for being with us, and see you next year.
Hey everybody, it's Greg McVicker, creator of Undercurrents. Glad you're listening. This is KBOO 90.7 Portland.
Hey, KBOO listeners, you want to tune in to PDX Progressive Talk Radio every fourth Wednesday at 7 p.m., where we do a deep dive into issues that matter most to our community. Every month, we're taking on homelessness, community policing, supporting local small businesses, and so much more. We're here to foster solutions and move progressive change. Brought to you by our dedicated team, me, Sherry Morish, and our host, Moses Ross, this show is your go-to for progressive dialogue and local action. Don't miss out on the conversations that are shaping Portland and the Pacific Northwest. Join us on PDX Progressive Talk Radio every fourth Wednesday at 7 p.m. right here on KBOO, where together, we're the voice of change.
from David Douglas Tag Center. We listen to KBOO, Portland, 90.7 FM.
We know a KBOO membership is at the top of everyone's wish list this season.